one session on class and race, and then the classical racial discussions. So what I'm going to do is keep my comments on the death of class debate down to a half hour, so at 25 till 11, I'll stop. I think I can get the main ideas laid out. This isn't that complicated. Then I think we should break down and take a break at the end of having broken down, and then we'll have 45 minutes for a reconvened discussion, which will perhaps focus a bit on the death of class debate per se, but we'll use that as a focal point for a wider range of discussion on the material that we've been doing so far. Okay. So the death of class debate. For anyone who is embedded in the Marxian tradition, the name of this debate just makes it seem absurd. Paul Kingston wrote a book a few years ago called The Classless Society. And to make the argument that the United States is a classless society just seems ridiculous to anyone who's embedded in the Marxian tradition, and even to most people who aren't. It just seems like an absurd statement. I don't think, in fact, this is a stupid discussion. The rhetoric may be a little excessive at times, and certainly the rhetoric can get misleading. But there nevertheless are some real issues involved in the claims that we are in a world today, unlike 50 or 60 years ago, where class no longer is a central structuring process in the lives of people. Even though inequalities remain acute and human suffering linked to those inequalities remains a pervasive problem, you therefore get formulations that say, as does Jan Pakulski's writing, where we are in a condition of complex classless inequality, where it is not inconsistent in that way of framing the question. It's not inconsistent to say that polarization of income is increasing, that desperate poverty is increasing, and yet class is decreasing as a way of structuring these realities that people live. That's the claim. And I think we need to see exactly what these claims are, decide in light of a clarification of what they are, whether how much energy should be devoted to critiquing them, engaging in both polemic and real research. How much of this is an empirical question, where there are some empirical indicators in play which could really adjudicate between these contending views? And how much is this simply a labeling question, where certain kinds of inequalities, which I would call clear indicators of the pervasive continuing importance of class, they simply want to use the word class in a much more restrictive way, so they won't call that class. So these are things that need to be sorted out. The death of class debate, like many debates, also becomes a favorite question on things like prelims. For those of you who are in the sociology game and will be facing exams at various times, this is a kind of classic problem that you will get a question of the form. Some people have said that the class is no longer a relevant category. Other people say it continues to be of great importance. Provide empirical evidence and theoretical discussion to clarify this debate. A question like that, that's a standard off-the-shelf PhD prelim exam question. So for no other reason than that, those of you who might in some distant or non-distant future take a prelim exam on this in this broad area, it's worth coming to terms with this and reading the stuff and figuring out what you think. So I've given in the readings there were two exemplars of this perspective. One is David Grusky, who actually adds further confusion to the discussion by describing what he's doing as rethinking the concept of class rather than rejecting it. But I think the whole thrust of his argument is completely consistent with the death of class thesis, and it just adds to the confusion of the issues that he wants to call what he's doing micro-class analysis, creating a theory of micro-classes. And the other is Jan Popolski. Jan Popolski is an Australian of Polish. I think he was educated in Poland, went to Australia in the early 1980s. I personally think that his work is the most interesting of the people who have written in this. He is the person who has the most interesting things to say about the Weberian tradition and its relationship to these problems, and has written repeatedly. So he's returned to the theme. So he has early versions, and then versions that take into account the criticisms of his early versions. And that's and he listens to his critics. So he's not just somebody who has a position and then just stubbornly says it. He keeps nuancing his argument. So if you're interested in this body of work, Jan Popolski, I think, is the most thoughtful of the people who have been writing this. David Grusky is a sociologist. He got his PhD here maybe 20 years ago at this point, a student of Bob Hauser, very prominent in the area of social stratification. He's the head of the Institute for Study of Social Inequality at Stanford, kind of a big player in global stratification research, mobility research, very sophisticated in terms of quantitative methods, you know, using somewhat esoteric, complicated modeling strategies to sort out these kinds of problems. His basic idea is the following. First of all, he sees class analysis as fundamentally about inequality. It's not so much about the macro institutions of a society, such things as whether a society is capitalist or not, but rather about the space of inequalities inhabited by persons, how people are located within a multidimensional space of inequality. When I've discussed these matters with David, and I said to him that if all there exists is microclasses, then how can you also say we live in a capitalist economy? Because capitalism is the name we give to a particular class form of organization of production. And he acknowledges that if you're using the word class to describe systems in that way, his arguments really don't pertain. He's talking about a different phenomenon, different issue. Classes as salient in locating individuals within a space of inequality. So he doesn't deny that private ownership of the means of production is a central feature of the economic structure we live in. What he is denying is that private ownership of the means of production enables you to locate individuals within a space of inequality very well. So his strategy is, let's define a space of inequality, and let's make it as atheoretical as possible in the first instance. Let's treat this as a descriptive space. Think of all the ways that people can be unequal. You can get a long list of these. Some of them are, many of them of these will be economic, that is, they will have to do with how things are produced and distributed, and the conditions under which they're produced, and so on. But not all of them will be. So in the first place, let's have a completely open-ended list of inequalities. That's the full, long, multidimensional space of inequality. Then let's narrow it down to economic inequalities, and let's see how well structured is this space. So what goes into that list? Well, here's some possible ingredients of this space of inequality. Income, education, wealth, authority, risk of various sorts, and a variety of dimensions of risk, status, meaning status within an economic structure, well-being, working conditions, exposure to health hazards, physical demands on your body in work. You know, you can have a big list of things. So you can say some people's work is much more physically demanding than others, so we can have a scale that goes from extremely physically demanding to not demanding at all, and we can locate people with respect to that dimension. Then the question is, how is this space of inequality structured? how do these different dimensions fit together? Do they constitute coherent configurations or not? The things on that list are real. That is, how physically demanding is your workplace is a real attribute of your work. It's something which real human beings experience. It happens to them. Having your back go out because you're stooping with a short-handled hoe in the strawberry fields is a real property. It's not just something in the heads of a theorist. It's not an arbitrary descriptor of that work setting. It's a real property in the world. How much?
But I don't really understand why you're saying real as opposed to what's not real.
The aggregated categories in which we want to put these things. Okay. That's the nominal categories. When we want to aggregate them, one way of aggregating them is to say, on theoretical grounds, I believe that everybody who is without ownership of the means of production and under the authority of managers is in the same category. Right? And that's what he would call a nominal class, because it's just something we are naming. But it may or may not be a real class. Whether it's real, it depends upon whether these real attributes aggregate along those lines. How much do they hang together? So that's the kind of premise of the analysis. And so the question then is, what would be the best empirical strategies to demonstrate that these many dimensions of inequality are actually structured in a way that we can call class structuring, as opposed to some other way that they could be structured? One way they could be structured is that they're all completely independent of each other, that you can have high-paid, physically demanding work with lots of autonomy. You can have high-paid, physically demanding work with no autonomy. You can have low-paid, physically demanding work with lots of autonomy. You know, you get a very possible combination of everything. Nothing hangs together. That would be one case. That would be chaotic complexity. Or they could hang together very tightly, and they could hang together tightly in ways that correspond pretty closely to the theoretical arguments of abstract class theories like Marxism. And that's his empirical challenge. He adopts two strategies for doing this, for sort of sorting out these questions. One he refers to as the pure strategy, the other as the effect-calibrated strategy. The pure strategy begins by defining the relevant dimensions of the space of inequality that you want to study. Now, to study all of them, to have a full list with, you know, 50 dimensions, becomes completely intractable. So he, as well, argues that you need to limit your inequality space. And the things you limit them to are things which you know are important individually, that is, each of the elements are important in people's lives. And then you want to see whether they hang together. He basically groups the dimensions into three clusters, which correspond to what most sociologists talk about when they talk about these issues. The investments and endowments that people have, the working conditions that they experience, and the rewards they get. So, you know, if you have an inequality space, you can say, well, one cluster of inequalities are all about the investments and endowments that the actors have. Another dimension are all the different aspects of their working conditions. And a third is the nature of the rewards you get out of work, in particular income, but various other kinds of rewards one could include as well. And the task then is to develop a method which would reveal the shape of the space. And what he proposes is what he calls latent class modeling, which, you know, it's part of a family of methods that includes factor analysis and various other kinds of methods which posit the existing of some underlying unobservable variable and then attempts various ways of modeling observations that you, or variables that you do have direct observations of, to see how they relate to some underlying latent class in this case. In the paper from the book, How Class Works, I think the chapter was called Are There Social Classes? He illustrates this in a nice way. It's a series of graphs which show different possible latent classes that could emerge from such an analysis. So that's one strategy, is this latent class model. The other strategy is effect calibrated. And that's a case where you ask the question, do the various dimensions that constitute a configuration of dimensions, you know, that come together to form these latent classes, do they have emergent properties? Do they have emergent properties, which means that are there consequences of the whole that are distinct from the consequences of each of the parts? An emergent property of a configuration means that the configuration as such is consequential, as opposed to all the elements which make up the configuration. Does the whole have consequences distinct from the separable consequences of each of the parts? One way of thinking about this, just by analogy, is in chemistry. Water is H2O. It's a whole. It's a compound. It's made of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. But it's not just two of H and one of O. It's two of H and one of O combined in a very specific way through chemical bonds and so on. The nurturing of plants by putting water on them is not simply the sum of the effects of exposing plants to hydrogen and exposing them to oxygen. It's a result of the effects of this interactive phenomenon that we call water. So in chemistry, there is no question, I think, that compounds have emergent properties. That there's nothing wrong in talking about how much water plants need. And no one would say that's sloppy, that's a sloppy discussion. You really should talk about how much hydrogen and how much oxygen and what ratios they need. Indeed, one would say that anyone who would try to reduce the explanation for how much water plants need to how much hydrogen and oxygen they need would be missing the point. They would not be understanding the actual way that these molecules come to make the growth of plants possible. It comes through the compound. Well, he wants to do the same kind of exercise for class analysis. He wants to say there's all these underlying dimensions of inequality. We believe, people who argue that class is important say that class matters for things like social conflicts, voting behavior, the identities that people hold, their class, their consciousness, I mean, all these things that we use class to explain. And the question is, are these things really just explained by all the underlying dimensions, that each of which has a little impact on people's lives? So your education affects you a bit, your income affects you a bit, your neighborhood affects you a bit, how demanding and obnoxious your bosses are affects you a bit. I mean, all these things help explain your consciousness. But they do so separately. And the fact that they often occur together just means that you're often going to be exposed to many of these individual separable effects, and that will increase the chance of voting in a particular way. But it's not because they hang together as a configuration. It's just because they all have little effects on you. As opposed to, it's really the configuration that explains the consequence. So that's his effect-calibrated strategy. And he argues that if you argue that a class exists, that there is, that the working class exists as a real category, not just as a convenient shorthand for all the things that workers typically, how they're typically located within the space, but you believe it actually exists, then what you have to show is that the things you want to explain are better explained by that aggregate category than by all the underlying dimensions that make it up. Another way of saying this, Grusky doesn't quite say it this way, but it's, I think, essentially the same, is that if you had an equation, so I'm going to just reduce this to this quantitative way of thinking, if you had an equation and there's five dimensions of inequality, and you add them into the equation as additive terms, that there will still be explanatory power in the interactions. So that if, to really strip it down, if being a worker is to not own the means of production and to be subordinated within production, so let's just take those two dimensions, if you have an equation that has either as a dichotomy or a continuous variable ownership of the means of production, and another variable that is domination, your position within domination, you need a third term, which is the interaction between the two. So that if you're both dominated and own the means of production, that will also have consequences. The interaction has consequences. The claim that there is an effect of the configuration, that there are emergent effects, is very close to the claim that there are interaction effects. And that if you drop the interaction term, your explained variance, to be really crude about it, would go down. The water example isn't quite like that because there are no additive terms.
Right.
Water affects the growth of plant not because there's any effect of the presence of hydrogen by itself or oxygen by itself. All the effect comes through the interaction. So that's why, you know, the analogy helps a little bit, but it can also be a little misleading. Okay, that's Gruskin's 2 points. Let me quickly talk about Kapulski, because I do want to stick to my shortened regime today. Kapulski's argument is that we are basically in a world of complex classless inequality. A slightly softer view is that we are rapidly moving towards such a world. You know, he probably rhetorically overstates his case, but I don't think that should be taken as a major criticism. You know, people in the context of debates and the polemics of debates, people often overstate their position in order to make it really clear. I think he would probably admit he slightly overstates it, but the basic thrust is we're moving towards classless, complex inequality and away from a class-structured form of inequality. This involves three theses. First, the classness of social inequalities vary. It's a variable, how much classness there is in a form of inequality. Second, classness peaked in industrial society and has been declining ever since. And third, contemporary societies remain unequal, but in mainly classless ways. From Weber, he develops an idea that there are three primary generative structures that produce inequality. The first centers around the centrality of property and employment relations. The second is the centrality of class structure in shaping other social relations. This is the correspondence between class relations and group formation. Rushing through my notes too hurriedly here. The three generative structures are the classic Weber triplet of class, status, and power, but really the way Pakulski elaborates them, I think, is clearer. The generative triplet of generative structures are rights, property rights, and market freedoms. That's the first type of generative structure. The second is values and conventions of honor, that's status. And the third is corporate bureaucracies, especially the state, which get in Weber's famous essay, Class, Status, and Party, that gets confused because of the use of the word party, which doesn't seem to be really about bureaucracy. These three clusters of mechanisms, these are real mechanisms in the world, property rights and market freedoms, systems of values and honor, and bureaucratic authority. These are three real structures that exist and generate effects. They get organized in different ways, in different matrices, which distribute societal power and individual life chances. a full-blown class structuration, a configuration where these all combine and reinforce each other, is rare and unstable, Apolsky argues. When, and here is a quote, when sociocultural articulation is weak, that is when strata boundaries are blurred, group identities and solidarities are weak, distances are cross-cutting, and divisions are fickle, when those conditions occur, social inequalities may take complex and unstratified form. Late modernity marks a shift in this direction of complex inequality. That is, in late modernity, these four properties occur. Strata boundaries are blurred. Group identities and solidarities are weak. Distances are cross-cutting. And divisions are fickle. This is what he gets from Weber. From Durkheim, he gets the notion of functional differentiation, in which he wants to argue that this is a substantive thesis about the nature of society, substantive claim, that in the course of economic development and modernization, there is increasing functional differentiation in the roles people fill, in which occupational differentiation is one of the most important of these forms of functional differentiation. Occupational differentiation is a differentiation of what people actually do within economic activities. These are natural kinds, they're not just arbitrary. The labeling may be arbitrary, but these are natural kinds. There are real clusters of things that people actually do. And the differentiation is driven by functional requirements. This is the Durkheimian view. They're driven by functional requirements. The distinction between an engineer and a technician is one that becomes increasingly clear and important as technologies change and roles become more important. It's not just an exercise of power by engineers that they establish credentials which distinguish them from technicians. Rather, the credentialing of engineers is a ratification of a functional distinction between engineering and being a technician. The timing of the emergence of that credential may be the result of power struggles. The precise boundary between an engineer and a technician may be the result of a power struggle. But the credentialing of engineering labor and of that occupation is the result of occupational specialization driven by functional differentiation. And therefore, it serves a purpose besides simply protecting the interests of engineers. It serves a purpose in the overall organization of the division of labor. That's Weber's kind of perspective, and which Pakulski endorses very strongly. Occupations are the product of spontaneous differentiation and organic social clustering. They form genuine moral communities and engender strong identities. That's a quote from Grusky, but it is exactly Pakulski's point as well. This then leads to his particular view about complex classless inequality. Complex classless inequality is the result of the dynamic of increasing occupational differentiation and functional specialization. It's driven by that, which sets in motion a set of ramifications which introduces complexity and incoherence in the overall configuration of the structure of inequality. The way Pakulski describes synoptically this causal dynamic process, class formation is first weakened by occupational differentiation and market fragmentation. That's the first thing that happens. The coherence of classes is weakened by increasing occupational differentiation. Then it's undermined by the unraveling of corporatist ideals, that's basically solidarities, and finally destroyed by the decomposition of class elites, organizations, parties and trade unions, and ideologies. And so you end up, at the end of this process, with a complex system of inequality anchored in occupational differentiation, but occupational differentiation that creates micro-solidarities around occupations that are not aggregated or aggregatable into collectivities because those collectivities have no coherence. And that's where Pakulski and Grusky really are saying the same thing. Grusky argues that we live in a world of micro-classes where plumbers and electricians are really distinct classes. The probability of the child of a plumber becoming a plumber is vastly greater, orders of magnitude greater, than the child of a plumber becoming an electrician, for example. I know that Grusky's favorite example is that the child of a sociologist has a hugely higher probability of becoming a sociologist than any other occupation. And it's true. If you look at the children of all professors of sociology and say, what is the single occupation that has the highest probability among that entire set of children, it turns out to be sociology. Now, there's a pretty low probability that the child of a sociologist becomes a sociologist, but it's still higher than that they become an economist or a historian or a lawyer or a doctor. Now, that's pretty surprising, because lawyer is a much bigger category than sociologist. Grusky says this is a report from Grusky. He says he's done this research. I haven't seen the actual data. But if it were true, it's an interesting fact. You know, as my children used to say, a true fact, if it's true. And it's an interesting thing, and it could have implications for how you think about occupations, for sure, and occupational inheritance. The question is whether it follows from that this is also has implications for how you think about class. The fact that the mobility chances are so much higher within occupations than across occupations, does that mean that the mechanisms identified by occupation are more important than the mechanisms identified by class for some of the things we want to explain? Well, that's what's in play in this discussion. In my notes, I raise four issues about the nature of these, about the nature of the complexities and whether their implications are the implications that the anti-class theorists claim. In order to stick to the regimen for today's discussion, I won't repeat all of these points, but let me just repeat one, which I think is particularly telling. And this became part of a direct exchange between me and Pakulski in a symposium that we were involved in the late 90s, in which I invoke the example of a factory that was owned by workers versus owned by capitalists, by share owners, and said that the issue of whether or not class continues to exist and matters, if it doesn't exist, then it should not matter whether workers own the factory or capitalists own the factory. That is, a worker co-op, an automobile factory that was a worker co-op, the workers were the full owners of the co-op, as in Mondragon in Spain. It shouldn't matter at all for the behavior of the firm and the fate and interests and life chances of the workers, whether they owned it or it was owned by outside share owners, and that would not count as a distinction in the class structures of these firms. I wrote that passage as if it was transparently obvious that it mattered, that being in a co-op made a big difference. Pakulski wrote in his reply, Wright's example of relocating a factory actually shows how immaterial the pattern of ownership can be to life chances. A socialist cooperative might choose not to relocate, but would, ceteris paribus, fail in the face of lower overseas labor costs anyway, and the, quote, workers would still lose their jobs. It is relative international competitiveness and not the existence of capital that would decide the outcome under conditions of globalization. Now, that's a pretty strong claim that he's making. He is, in fact, making the counterclaim that it really just doesn't matter who owns what. All that matters is that you're selling for a market. That's sufficient to define what the interests of the and fate of the actors would be. This is equivalent to a famous statement that Paul Samuelson made, which was, It doesn't matter whether workers hire capital or capital hires workers. The behavior of firms would be absolutely indistinct whether workers hire capitalists or capitalists hire workers. Well, there's a nice economic literature showing why that's not true, why it does matter. The economics literature on this all has to do with market imperfections and information and transactions costs. I think in a sociological sense, we can see why it matters, because the nature of the labor process and the forms of solidarity fundamentally transform the way in which workers will relate to the process of production and the kinds of strategies that are open to the members of that cooperative firm, the kinds of strategies that are available for coping with various kinds of competitive threats that are not available if the firm is a capitalist firm. The optimal strategy for a capitalist, what they do in the face of such competition, and the optimal strategies of workers, what they do in the face of such competition, would be very different. And the difference in their strategies reflects the difference in the class relations of the firms. And that's the kind of argument that I made in reply to Pakulski. Okay, well, that's only 5 minutes over what I promised. I think that's not too bad. Rather than ask me questions about this in light of what I've said, and of course on the assumption that you all read the lecture notes as well, why don't we break down, and any issues that were going to be raised or to me can get raised in the small groups. It'll be a quarter till by the time we actually get organized. Let's have the small groups meet. Is 25 minutes enough, or do you want 30? Let's make it 30 minutes. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll have a half hour for reconvene discussion, okay? And do we want to go for slightly smaller groups? Should we do five? It'll be five groups of about five people. That seem right? Okay, let's go five. So just, I think randomly seems to be the best alternative.